Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is my friend and our Chapel Hill neighbor, Kimberly Kaiser, an experienced person in front of the microphones here at WCHL. Welcome back, Kimberly.
Thank you. It's fun to be back.
Among many other things, you're an artist, designer, and writer, and now the author of a really beautiful new book called Ticket, Guidebook for the Table. I want you to talk to us, if you will, about the new book and the importance of proper manners at and around the table and other places, and how some of those complicated rules developed over the centuries. One of my favorite parts of your book is about how your growing up experiences in Chapel Hill and other places prepared you to write this book. You want to talk about that?
Well, yes. I have a I'm a mishmash of influences. I was born in Hollywood, California, when my father, Kay Kaiser, and mother, Georgia Carroll, were still in show business. And so I was before the camera when I was, I was probably not even a year old. I was in a fashion show with children of the stars, and I was with Candace Bergen and Mia Farrow, who was older, and some other kids. And you can still see that on film. It's called Gail Patrick's Enchanted Cottage. And this was a Hollywood woman that had a little clothing store.
So you had a child movie star career that ended early.
Very early. And I was photographed a lot just as the firstborn of at the time somebody very famous. And then my father and mother both had the good sense to take my sister Carol and me away from that whole spotlight and bring us back to North Carolina, which is my father's home state, his beloved home state. He was such a booster of North Carolina and called himself, even in show business, he called himself the man from the South. Even in a time when it wasn't fashionable to be Southern. So he claimed that and really capitalized on being a Southern gentleman, and not that he didn't have some frisky sides to him in a playful way. But so I grew up in Chapel Hill.
Well, just for anybody who doesn't know what you're talking about in terms of the Kaiser family, particularly your dad and your mom, these are famous people who came to live with us for a time, and they continue to be famous because of your dad's. It's still fun to watch the films that he did on, and it's and your mother may have been the most beautiful woman that the world has ever produced.
Well, she
and
was called that by one of the agents.
So that your, your heritage is just an incredible asset for your friends, but. So what did that have to do with what did that have to do with your book, your new book about
Well,
manners?
It didn't have much to do with it specifically, except that the preface is sort of a memoir of to say, you know, well, who am I? Why did I step up and write this book? And why do I know any more than Emily Post? And I don't, but I am of a certain generation that grew up at the table with a lot of emphasis on decorum and respect for the elders and respect for the moment of sitting at the table. And then the generation after mine and ours is people were hurried and both parents worked and people didn't sit down at the table. And slowly but surely, you could see this whole ritual of dinner slipping away. And kids now just don't know anything about how to hold a fork and a knife, and they stab and do things that are misrepresent their intelligence and their education. So it's really, this is a funny book in that it's, as I was writing it, I thought, you know, this is a love letter to Chapel Hill, because it's, I'm so thankful to have been raised here where the emphasis has been on education and an open-mindedness about people who gathered here because of the university, people from all over the world. It was, in a way, a village, but an international village. And the exchange of ideas continues today to be rich. But it sort of breaks my heart to see that this social skill of table manners is
ignored. You've been asked to give talks and counsel with students at Carolina in various places. Talk about what students today, based on your experience, don't know that they might be better off knowing? What is it? What are the specifics of the specifics?
I was drawn into counseling the students because of my apparel design business and experience as a wardrobe consultant, which I changed into when I came back to North Carolina. I lived in Atlanta for 22 years and moved back here, and so I ended up being more of a consultant than a designer. And I was called in to counsel some students. One of the first things that I was drawn into to try to figure out a way to tactfully tell them that when you're an intern in a boardroom for a meeting, you don't come in your cut-off jeans if you're a girl and flip-flops. You need to present yourself in a dignified way. It doesn't mean you have to put on a suit, but it means, you know, to respect the context in which you're functioning.
So this book on manners, which moves towards table manners, really got your interest got started in the way of helping young people decide and understand the in our society what the appropriate thing is to wear.
It's basically the whole thing is about self-presentation. And we all know packaging and marketing, and not to be cold-blooded about it and commercial, but, you know, we meet each other and we are visual creatures, and you pick up on body language and how you dress and your manners and are you aware of how other people feel in your presence? Are you sensitive to their needs and comfort and respect their points of view and way of doing things? That's too long a way to say that there's an isolation, I guess everybody would agree, with this technological age. So many young people are looking down at phones and not talking to each other, and it extends to the table. They just don't have a clue what to do at the table. So to say I got into this through the dress business is not exactly completely the story, because I do have a lifelong experience, which I talk about in the preface, of international travel, which I had in that sense, I had a very privileged childhood and early education, in that my family and my parents just put a huge emphasis on travel. And we traveled in a very old school way, many times on ocean liners in first class with very formal dining, and we had to rise to the occasion. And we spent months in Europe, and so that influence is huge in my life. It was life altering.
What did being overseas, what more did that have to do with your understanding and appreciating and wanting to share the manners and how you act at the table and how you act and eat at the table?
Because it was at a time when Americans were beginning to travel more and more often to Europe, and they didn't make a very good showing. There was my parents always emphasized our not being the ugly American, demanding. Americans tend to travel in Europe, particularly Western Europe, demanding the things that they have at home. If certain foods and practices, ice and iced tea and things like that you take for granted. I mean, back in the 50s and 60s, the Europeans didn't have the average household did not have an ice maker, and they didn't drink their beverages with lots of ice. And so small things, I did, a sensitivity to the context, what you ask for and what you don't, and how you learn to blend so that you represent your own country well, but you also are respectful of the country in which you're a visitor. And that was a profound learning experience. Mm. Mm. And my parents were pretty strict about that, you know, just don't raise your voice, just go with the flow.
Okay. Well, we're visiting with Kimberly Kaiser. We're going to talk about, really, her new book called Ticket. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Kimberly Kaiser, our friend and neighbor here in Chapel Hill. She has a new book. It's called Ticket, A Guidebook for the Table. It's a sweet, small book that's manageable to read, and that's one of the things that I loved about it. Kimberly, we talked a little bit earlier on about how your growing up in Chapel Hill prepared you and led you to have the information and the willingness and the tenacity to write this book. I'd like to talk to you, or have you talk to us, about some of the rules that you talk about in your book. The one that stood out to me is, I mean, there were a whole bunch of rules that I violated. So
we all do.
So the first one, and I want to kind of get off the hook on some of these things because it's going to be hard for me to break my habits about it. But the first one was, don't cut bread at the table.
You don't use your knife. You pinch it off.
Yeah, but why can't I cut it? I always cut my bread. So one of the rules, this is a pretty firm rule, right? Don't cut bread.
Well, let's back up. The way I put this together is I explained that learning table manners, if you know nothing, and a lot of young people don't know anything, zero, is like learning a foreign language or learning ballroom dancing that has a lot of rules.
Yeah, I love that. Right.
The formal, when you learn grammar in school, you learn the formal rules of the subjunctive mood, all the other tenses, how you use them. And then we all lapse into slang. You know, because it's casual. So I said, we're starting with learning the most formal rules, and then, of course, they'll relax if you're just having dinner around the kitchen table with your family. So that rule, each thing I presented, I researched it very carefully to make sure that the British books and the American books concur. And if you see a rule repeated over and over and over again, it stands to reason that's the nice way to do it. To me, it looks crude as somebody in a nice dinner party, and we're talking nice dinner party where you're dressed up, and there's a butter plate with a roll on it and a separate piece of butter for you that's been presented.
And a separate butter knife.
And a butter knife and all that. To take that knife, you have to hold the whole piece of bread in your hand and saw it with the knife, and that just is indelicate. If you just do as you do in India, quietly pinch a little piece off one bite and put enough butter on that and put it in your mouth. It's less distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And you see people take the entire piece of bread, slice it in half, and slather it with the butter. And it looks like, I don't know what it looks like. It looks like you're a short order cook in a fast food place or something. It's just, I don't care. You do what you want to, but just one little fine point
part of the charm of the book, I think, is that it's not going to tell you everything that you're doing right. It's going to tell you a few things that you're doing wrong. And
it tells you a lot of things you do right.
Yeah, no, you did. Yeah, you did. But for instance, another place where you caught me sort of doing wrong is about cutting meat. And cutting meat, if you cut, you cut off a slice at a time according to your rule, and if you cut two or three pieces at a time and then eat them without cutting again, that would be not good manner. That would not be good table etiquette.
You look like you're preparing a plate for a child when you.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And I can't imagine that you do that, DG. But reverting to childhood.
No, but I mean, but that's really important to me to know that. Okay, I'm free to do that at my house. I can eat it. But if I'm out at a formal dinner, maybe I ought to follow Kimberly's advice and just cut one little piece at a time and eat it.
Well, and then the other part of that cutting ritual routine is that there are two styles.
I want to talk. Tell us about the American and the European style of
holding.
Well,
that was interesting because I had ingrained in me early on from all the travel and from education and boarding school, and I studied in France in college. I switched over to the continental style, which is very efficient. And that means
What are the differences?
Okay, the continental style is that you hold the fork in your left hand. The prongs are down. You stabilize the meat with the fork. You cut with the knife in your right hand. And without changing, without zigzagging the fork back into the right hand and putting the knife down, as the Americans do, you continue to eat sort of seamlessly. You just keep the prongs of the fork facing down with the meat now atop, one little bite is attached mm-hmm. to the fork, and you rotate slightly to put this in your mouth, and you return the fork to the plate and do it again to cut. So it's there's less fuss and shifting of utensils.
And how do the Americans generally do it?
They zigzag, and it's called.
They put the.
They cut the meat. They hold. They do the same thing. They cut. They hold the fork in the left, prongs down, to stabilize the meat. They cut a piece of. They use the knife in the right to cut the piece of meat. So. But then
they put the knife down on the table,
or the knife at the top of the plate. Switch the fork back over to the right hand. Turn the prongs up, and then take the bite that way. And then they shift it back. So every time you take a bite, you're shifting it back and forth. And all the really good American etiquette writers for decades have said that this is not a very attractive way to eat. But it's not outlawed. I mean, it's a tradition in America. And at the back of the No, it wasn't in the back. I put it in that meat section. My good friend, John Sweet, an American historian, at the last minute handed me a book about why Americans eat this way. And it's because we as a continent were isolated for a century. So we lagged behind the British, who were already lagging behind a century from the Italians of using the fork. But we were isolated, so we didn't. And all Americans had to eat in the early colonial period, there were spoons and knives.
Well, you know, I'm okay with that.
So they used their fork as they would a spoon by turning it up.
Well, all right, let's get back to that now, because I love the efficient way in which the continental people eat and not having to spend a lot of time shifting. And I'm glad that you approve of that,
because that's the
easier way to do it.
And your forearms sort of rest relaxed on the table always.
But I've got a problem.
What?
And that is that you've got me with my fork prongs pointed down towards the plate to lift it up. And then, I eat a little bite of meat, and then I want to go eat my potatoes. Can I turn the prongs over and use it as a, I have to try.
Just smear the potato on the back of the fork and keep on going.
And can I use the knife to do that?
You absolutely use the knife.
So I use the knife to smear it on top.
Just push it onto the back of the fork.
But Kimberly.
It stays.
Isn't it more natural to put it in a fork that has a bottom to it, that where the prongs bring it up?
That's just my personal.
Is that personal or is that absolute?
No, I mean, if you look at Emily Post, she says Americans are the ones that flip it over, even with the fork in the left hand, and use the knife like a broom to sweep it into the dustpan.
Help me with this. So this is your preference, but it might not be an absolute to use the fork.
No, it's not. You see it a lot. I think it doesn't look very.
You like it.
It's not hard to push food on the back of your fork.
The most important good news is that you tell me I can use that knife as a pusher to put it onto the fork.
You absolutely do use
prongs up or prongs down, but you prefer prongs down.
As a pusher, definitely.
All right. Now the other, are you okay with Mike learning from you like this?
Sure.
Because the other part where you caught me is that you say absolutely no mixing. But if I've got potatoes and peas along with my good meat.
Where did I say that?
Yeah, you just say don't be mixing up food on your plate.
I can't remember.
You back away from that. Good. Okay. It's time to take a break.
Okay.
I'm learning so much from Kimberly Kaiser, and you would learn more, too, if you read her new book, Ticket, A Guidebook for the Table. But you're going to learn some more after she and I take a short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin visiting with our friend and neighbor, Kimberly Kaiser. She has a new book called Ticket, A Guidebook for the Table. And she's been good enough to give me some specialized personal instruction that I need. And Kimberly, we're talking about there's some common sense and not so complicated, but some unknown ways in which you can handle your silverware. You mentioned that you see people just using their knives just to sort of stab the food.
No, what I see, and I've been asked to talk to students about the sort of the basic things of coming to the table is how you hold the fork and the knife. And what so many young people do today, and older people too, and it is a very distinguishing thing when people get labeled as not educated or something when they do this. It's that people now think it's okay to hold the fork.
Like a dagger, kind of.
And it's perpendicular to the plate, and you're just stabbing something, and you're using your other arm in this with your elbows out like you're a bird flying, and you're sawing away at the stuff, and it looks really awkward.
Describe the rules. Sound kind of complicated. It's really not complicated.
It's not a bit complicated.
But tell us how should you hold? Like a pencil?
The fork is stabilized by the three fingers below, and I can't remember how I wrote it, but I explain it, and I also have pictures, a lot of pictures of how to hold a fork and a knife, and don'ts, like don't hold, and there's a picture of somebody stabbing and swinging the knife in the air while you talk. That's just not attractive and never was accepted, and it goes back to history.
Well, tell us about that history, because have we always used these three primary instruments at our table, the knife and the fork and spoon,
the most important has always been the knife in the earliest, because the caveman developed some way to have a knife to cut the meat. They went in the woods and killed it, and they needed to, and they ate with the knife, I would think, to a certain extent. And the next thing that could evolve was a spoon, which was first something to scoop
before
liquids.
The fork.
Oh yes, way before the fork, and that was with us for centuries. And then in the Middle East, in I would say around 1100, in the Byzantine Empire, the fork became a useful tool. And it's the Venetians who had this trade in the
who?
Venetians.
Venetians.
Who brought that to Italy because of the trade route.
They found out about this new instrument.
And, it existed to a certain extent as a serving utensil, but it then became the table fork, which was a different use, and gradually in the very early Renaissance, the Venetians always had included that, and the Italians then as a whole had a fork in the table setting, and they were a century before the British and the French, and so they were style setters at a certain point.
What were the, at this point in time, what were the British and the French using to get the food to their mouth and when they went to a meal?
Well, it wasn't done crudely, but it was cut and either eaten with your hand nicely or, I think there was still a taboo putting the knife into your mouth, although so many records talk in their don'ts. Talk about don't pick your teeth with a knife. So apparently people were.
I don't do that.
No, it had a sharp point, and so they would use it for a different thing, cutting the meat and cleaning their teeth. But many taboos evolved out of that. The prevalence of a knife at the dinner table, because in the Middle Ages people get in a fight and jump up and stab each other with their, because it was a weapon by day and cutlery by night.
Well, the knives back then had a point on them. The knives today don't have a point.
That was changed in the French courts. They finally, I think it was Louis XIV that rounded the end. He didn't want people to pick their teeth anymore with this instrument. And secondly, he wanted people to be well behaved and not even think of it anymore as a weapon. If I may segue into a question I get all the time, is why the name ticket? Well, I wanted something playful that meant many different things and was not threatening. But in fact, the word ticket is the English definition of a word that became into use during the reign of Louis XIV. The old French is estiquette. And the French in the time of Louis XIV is etiquette. And the definition of that is a card or a placard or a ticket, a piece of paper. So it means
with rules on it.
It had little rules on it. And he posted these stickers, these tickets, all through the court to remind his courtiers. Some of which he brought in from the country would behave well and make a good impression on foreign visitors that were being courted by Louis for commercial reasons and social as well,
Well, this is interesting for a lot of reasons. And the first one, in terms of the word origins, that, that ticket and etiquette sort of have the same root root word. The other is, and I learned a lot about history from reading your book, about what kind of domineering person Louis XIV was. A long reign in France, and we hear about him all the time, but he was not... He told people what to do, and he expected them to follow the rules, and so he wrote them out on little tickets.
Yeah.
And they, or he had somebody write them out on little tickets.
He also was a short man, and I write about
that. Oh, yeah. Tell us about that.
And he wore high heels, which was not a peculiar, you know, it was a style. But he painted his heels red, and he allowed the special courtiers to have their heels red as well. And you can see these red heels in some very famous portraits today on him, when portraits of Louis. But if the courtier went out of service or was in disfavor and continued to wear the red heel, either forgetting or deliberately wearing them, Louis would have him beheaded.
So
there were serious consequences to violating his etiquette.
So you got to be a red heel only with the king's permission, or you had to be higher enough in social order to have the red
heel?
It
was like so many things in clothing, in the evolution of clothing, that mark social status.
What did Louis XIV do with respect to the setting of the table and the management of the operation at the table that has an influence on what we do today?
We rounded the knife, number one, mm-hmm. and there are all sorts of details that are not so different from British and other Western countries. So I didn't really get into all that, but it's certainly a very formal experience at Versailles to be dining with Louis, and certainly it must have been intimidating, to say the least.
Well, you some of the things that you mentioned, both in terms of the setting of the table and in the orderliness of it, had to do with the serving of different courses at the meal. Now, did that develop just over time, or did Louis XIV institutionalize that in a way that has an impact on the way we do things in formal dinners today?
It actually changed in the 19th century when the tradition was that It was formal, but more communal. All the dishes were put on the table all at once, and you can see that in wonderful educational things like the Tudors, and you're watching Henry VIII eat, and so you see a lot of bowls, and there was a ritual to it. But you passed, and as you passed, would you like this? Would you like this? It created community, and it was conversational. But then the style shifted to one course at a time, and which changed a lot of things.
It seems like I love our tradition of sort of a common meal and passing the bowls and all of that. But the formality broke away.
But it was a different style. There was a formality even to the one where the bowls of food are already on the table. I mean, there's a certain rules and regulations. You didn't just want a free for all. But what shifted was the host or hostess and the chef became very powerful when it was one course at a time. So the menu was determined ahead of time versus the previous style. You have a lot of bowls, and you could pick and choose what your menu, how you would fix your own plate, you know, as you would in a Thanksgiving dinner. You have lots of different offerings, and you could leave off something The new formal way that was in courses, well, it's not new. Let me back up. Catherine de' Medici married the son of François Premier, And when she went from Italy to France, she took that tradition of eating in courses with her and introduced the French court to food in different courses and a lot of exotic foods like sorbet and cantaloupe. And she also introduced the knife, fork, and spoon setting to the French court. So it came from Italy. But in the late 19th century, the change to this everybody used, in particularly in British and American styles, the meals served in courses. It was also facilitated by the Sheffield industry in England.
They could make some money on making the products.
Impulse, but it could be so that each course then had a utensil that was shaped distinctly for that course, like the fish knife and the fish fork and the salad and the scale, and so you get this complicated table setting.
Well, if you join us late, I'm visiting with Kimberly Kaiser. We're talking about her new book, Ticket, A Guidebook for the Table. She and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with our friend and neighbor, Kimberly Kaiser. We're talking about her new book, Ticket, A Guidebook for the Table. And she explained to us why she has that interesting title. And I guess one of the reasons is that ticket and etiquette sort of come from the same root word, but there's some other reasons too. One of the things that Kimberly did as a part of the book was to do some research on the history of etiquette and the history sort of etiquette leaders and books. We know of, there were the Emily Post of Christmases of times past. And Kimberly, first of all, tell us how you got interested in that, and then in a few short words, just kind of take us through the history of etiquette advice in books, or give us some examples of that.
Well, how'd I get interested? Well, I've always been interested in writing this book for a long, long time, and began in earnest about 5 years ago, and I had some starts and stops, as one does writing a book. But at some point, I was trying to figure out how to tell young people how important this really is. It's about self-presentation, and it's a social skill that connects you with other people. It's much more than just a prissy little dance through teacup curtsies and, you know, silly stuff. It is a profound effect on how you affect other people, because so much social interaction, and 75% of all business is done over the table. Some form of eating or drinking coffee or something. But rather than just say in a sentence, you know, well, history says this is important, so it's important, I thought, well, don't just say it. Let's explore it and see how things evolved and how they changed. And, of course, they will continue to evolve to a certain extent, but there's still a core of rituals and of motivations for developing this social skill. And I have to say that a huge influence on my research came out of my studies in the Italian department at UNC. I've been an unofficial student in the Romance Languages and Literature department since 2002 and have studied Italian and speak adequate Italian now. And remember something that Dr. Rao, Ennio Rao, who was my teacher in summer school semester number one, Italian one, he said, you all, and he's speaking not to older people like me, but mainly to a class of young'uns, he said, you are going to study this foreign language, but you're going to learn more about your own culture in this pursuit than you will about Italian. And it was so true. So I can't exactly say how this pilgrimage kind of went from one step to the other, but reading the Renaissance Italian books made a profound impact on me, because so much of what was said and valued connected this through a circuitous path to be what we now regard as Southern culture. There are qualities that Castiglione, who wrote the Courtier, the Book of the Courtier, which I see kids quote all the time as if it's some la-di-da, cute little thing full of quips. And it's a serious book that wasn't even written for table manners, because people that were he was speaking to knew how to behave at the table. But it was how to behave in general in a changing world to people who were the courtiers in Italy in the Renaissance in the 16th century and late 15th century were being disempowered. Their foreign invasions were taking away their traditions and power, and they were learning to how to behave politely to sometimes despotic rulers that had taken over. And there's a correlation to today, to me.
I love this description in your book where you go back to the 1500s to find people who are writing about the way to act. And you had two guys, one you just mentioned, Castiglioni, mm-hmm. and the other,
Della
Casa. And they approached manners from sort of different perspectives. I want you to correct this, but one sort of from the how to get ahead and the other sort of how to from the heart, how to be a good person. What you explain the different approaches that Castiglioni and Della Casa took?
Castiglioni wrote earlier. He was the predecessor, and his book was considered probably the most magnificent, one of the most monumental works of literature in the Renaissance. It's not often taught now in the, you know, when you study Dante and Petrarch, and you don't really, I don't think, get down and read Castiglioni, but it's a powerful book. It's written almost like a memoir of a time past, four nights in a palace, and it's directed at courtiers who are
trying to please their
trying to please their new governor, ruler, mm-hmm. and they're losing their power. But it is not just about how to get ahead. It's also the base of it that was so moving to me is about dignity. How do you preserve? How do you maintain your own dignity and don't compromise your values, but still learn a way to be and to be polite and to not shoot yourself in the foot by being rude to somebody who controls your finances or future. And that's what seemed to resonate so much to me with the challenges of today, people in the workplace, you know, not really being thrilled that they're their bosses and how to be polite and so forth. Mm. So that then a generation later comes Giovanni Della Casa. He was a cleric. Both these men were aristocrats, Italian aristocrats. They traveled. They were confidants to the Pope. They traveled the world. They were highly educated, knew all they were classically trained.
How did, in a word, because we're almost out of time, how did Della Casa?
So Della Casa takes a whole different tact, and it's a short
book. In what way?
And he pretends to be an old, crude uncle talking to his nephew about how to be and what to do, and it's much more prescriptive. The other one is not prescriptive. It's philosophical.
So these are some rules like some of the rules you give us in your
summary.
Well,
they're very similar. I mean, it's like don't chew with your mouth full and, you know, don't burp at the table and don't – he says a lot of funny things like don't hang your nose over somebody else's glass or food because something may drop out, and he's not talking about you know, diamonds and pearls, which he goes on. It's very, very funny. So those are the two tacks. But those two books made their way into libraries in the colonial America.
In your wonderful book, you trace the history. Not that it absolutely begins with these two guys, but a lot of it does, and a lot of future etiquette writers, including Emily Post and you, rely on the rules of this guy 500 years from ago. But Kimberly Kaiser, is there one word that you'd like to that we've missed that you can give us in terms of something we do bad that you'd like to correct?
No, but I would just like if people when people buy this book and read it, that they say, "Hey, I didn't think table manners could be so sexy or so fun."
I would say I can say that. I hadn't gotten to the sexy part, but it is fun and interesting, and it's a whole lot more than just the rules for the table today. Although, as we learned earlier in this conversation, I did learn some things that I was doing wrong, and I thank you for teaching me, Kimberly Kaiser, for your book and for coming to visit with us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks to Kimberly Kauser. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking? I'll be back here before you know it.